Welcome to Two-Way Street. Unlike virtually every other modern American president, George H.W. Bush chose not to write a memoir after leaving office in 1993. In some ways, that's not surprising. Taught as a child by his mother that self-puffery was undignified, he was never comfortable talking about himself as a candidate for president or when he was in the White House. But what he didn't share publicly, Bush 41 did commit to a tape recorder. Hours and hours of his thoughts on his personal life and the moments in history he helped shape from the 1960s well into the 90s. The content of those tapes has never been made public until now. They're the spine of John Meacham's new biography of President Bush called Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Meacham is the former editor-in-chief of Newsweek and the current executive editor and executive vice president of Random House. In 2009, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Andrew Jackson. John Meacham, thank you for coming in to be on Two-Way Street. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
It strikes me that George H.W. Bush was very canny in allowing you complete access to his tapes, because we all know this is the president who never wrote a memoir himself.
Right.
And although you are certainly not writing his memoir, because you're taking a stance independent of him and commenting on his life and his performance in various positions he held, on the other hand, it does give him this opportunity to get this out without having to put his name on a book.
Exactly. You know, it's a shortcut, I guess. It is canny. I was a good bet. I was the editor of Newsweek, which was not a particularly Bush-friendly vehicle. And also, the other thing about the Bushes is they're very comfortable. George and Barbara Bush both are very comfortable with what they did. And their view is that a fair-minded historical take will produce a fairly balanced portrait of their place in history, of his place in history. It's a it was tough sometimes to decide where to let him tell the story, because you do have him talking. That's the other thing about this diary is, it's not written, which gives you a sort of an edit function, obviously, as you're writing it. But he did talk. It would be late at night. It would be early in the morning. He sometimes sounds like death itself. He's just whipped. You know, the election night 1992 is just a really tough, tough time. But it's a unique historical document. And so what I tried to do was let him create the ethos, put us in a way as close to the presidency as I've been with the diary, but still render the judgments that need to be rendered.
So what came first? Your decision that he was an appropriate subject for a biography, and then you began talking and negotiating over getting access to his diaries? Or did you talk to him and he said, you know, I'd be willing, if you want to write a book about it, to work with you?
A little bit in between. I realized pretty quickly after meeting him in 1998 that I would want to write about him at some point. And when I went to him with the concrete idea, what I wanted really, stupidly, because I hadn't quite focused on the diary as a resource at the early on, is I wanted him to talk. And the initial agreement was that it would be posthumous. Mm-hmm. So I thought that might encourage more candor. And interestingly, sort of a classic George Bush moment, what he said was, are you sure there's, what if you just find an empty deck of cards? Yeah. So it's a classic Bushism, because it's a malapropism. What he meant was, what if you find out I'm not playing with a full deck or I'm an empty suit? And he said, well, you should look at the diary. And I was about three pages in when I realized it was historical gold. And so,
what were the first things you read?
He's the president elect. He's at Camp David. He is complaining because Nancy Reagan has not shown Barbara the living quarters of the White House, and that was it for me. You had me at hello. You had me at the first Nancy Reagan line. And also, on a serious note, he had just gotten his briefing on his actual responsibilities in the operational code of nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. and talks about how stark and how sobering that briefing was. And even as vice president, it felt different to him. So, and that was literally the first three pages. One thing I thought about was doing sort of what my friend Michael Beschloss did with the Johnson tapes and just editing the diaries. But as I went through the diary and the president agreed to talk, I realized that a biography was worth the deep dive. And the only condition now is that I am going to publish the diaries, but those have to be posthumous.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about your book is I've had people who have said, well, what are you reading? Who's coming in to do your show? And your name comes up in this book. And there are people who say, well, why would I want to read about George Herbert right. Walker Bush? So those of us who are lucky enough to cover politics and cover presidential politics particularly, we get this unique opportunity to really take the measure of the people, quite separate from the speeches they give and their talking points, and even their stand on issues. We get an opportunity, don't you agree,
yep.
to take a measure of these people. And my answer to those folks who've wondered why a book about George H.W. Bush is, he's so much more interesting and complex mm-hmm. than you have any idea. And I think you believe that to be true now that you've really done this book.
Yeah, well, I agree completely. I was one of those people 20 years ago. I hadn't focused on him very much. Weirdly, as a president of the United States, people had not. And when they did in 1992, they found him wanting.
Yeah.
1992 was a perfect storm of bad news for George Bush. But I found the more time I spent around him, I found a quiet, persistent charisma. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny. Early on, I was talking to one of your colleagues in public broadcasting, and they said, I've heard you say that George Bush is charismatic, and I've asked around the office, and no one agrees. And I said, well, have they ever met him? And to his credit, he said, no. It's just a different kind of charisma. It's not John Kennedy. It's not Ronald Reagan.
Certainly not Bill Clinton.
And it's not, oh my Lord, no. And it's not, and let's not even talk about the current crowd. So I understand the skepticism about this. But in a way, my journey, which sounds pretentious, I don't mean it that way, but my odyssey in this as well was going from wondering why one would want to read about him to wanting to write about him and feeling really as though I don't think you can I know you can't understand modern American politics without understanding this man.
Yeah. You say at one point that his was one of the great American lives, strong parents, sparkling education, heroic service in World War II, congressman. And you then go on and talk about his accomplishments in the White House. He peacefully ended the communist threat, secured the heart of Europe, struggled to end chaos in the Middle East. And that's not even mentioning his domestic accomplishments, like passing the Americans with Disabilities Act, among other things. And these are the things we easily overlook about George Bush. His story is the story of great Americans in the middle of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And for good and for bad.
Yeah.
There's the rise of the right wing in the Republican Party. There's the end of compromise as a reasonable Washington phenomena. He moved south and west right after graduating from Yale, just as the political gravity of the country was moving south and west. If he had stayed in New England, we would not be sitting here talking about it.
Yeah, he ended up in Houston, of course.
He ended up
in the oil business.
Exactly. And if he hadn't gone to Texas, he wouldn't have been president. If he hadn't married Barbara Bush, he wouldn't have been president. But this is a man who embodies the story of American power in the last 50 years and more. When you go back through his family, his father was a senator, his grandfathers were Gilded Age barons. He had a great-grandfather who was an Episcopal priest who lost his faith, which seems kind of redundant. But it's a big American story. I chose the subtitle with great care. It is an American odyssey.
He was also driven from the time he was very, very young to be intensely competitive. Talk about tree climbing in the Bush household.
They were expected. It's funny. There was Prescott Jr., George, Jonathan, Nancy, and Bucky. Those were the Bush children, the children of Prescott and Dorothy Walker Bush. And there were tall trees on their land, in their yard on Grove Lane in Greenwich. And it was just an ambient expectation that the children would go out and climb to the top of the trees. And it was just expected. And at one point, a neighbor comes over and says, "Mrs. Bush, the children might fall." And she says, "Well, you have to learn somehow." Mrs. Bush learned how to swim by being thrown in the Atlantic Ocean by one of her Walker uncles. She once broke her wrist in the middle of a tennis match, continued playing, and won. These are tough, tough people. And it was a Victorian, Edwardian kind of muscular Christianity. It was athletics were a maker and a measure of character.
Yeah, yeah. So he's intensely competitive. At the same time, he's being told by his family that winning is
totally
hugely important. It's everything in some ways.
Being told, just to add a level of nuance here, as John Kerry would say, I think that love in the Bush household was unconditional, but that admiration and respect were earned.
Yeah.
And I don't think they ever sat down and said, "This is what you've got to do." I think it was all the more powerful for being, again, ambient and unspoken because you wanted to be the number one boy because that was the way you were admired, respected, deferred to.
Yeah. Yeah. And we all know, I think, the story that his mother cautioned him over and over again, don't talk about yourself.
Right.
I mean, that's a relatively well-known
sure.
aspect of his upbringing, which is probably one of the reasons there were times on the campaign trail and in the presidential campaign trail that he was having trouble knowing how to talk about himself. Right?
Well, Peggy Noonan finally stopped using the first person pronoun in the speeches. She would just say, "Went to Congress, moved to Texas, served in China," just avoided the first person pronoun altogether. But I asked him one morning in the course of, we did interviews from 2006 until 2015 for this book. One morning in Houston, I asked him, I said, what was it? What made you go? And he said, "Service." And he always said that. Service was the motivating force. And I said, "Well, that's fine, Mr. President, but you could have opened a soup kitchen. You sought ultimate authority in a nuclear age. There's something more going on." And he sort of went, "Eh." 6 hours later, we were having a drink at the Bush's house. And without reference to the fact that he was answering a question that had been asked 6 hours earlier, he suddenly sort of perks up and says, "Be number one. Be the captain of the team. Do well. Be number one." In some ways, that's bad, but in some ways, it's not. Mm-hmm. And so he confessed to it ultimately. And I do think it was it competition for competition's sake is an interesting question. And I think that part of the culture in which he grew up is the answer is yes. It's when you marry the competitiveness to the service, to the idea that to whom much is given, much is expected, that you get the political path.
The book is filled with so many stories, and you've told his life story so well that we are not going to cover all this that ground. But I would really love to focus on some key parts of his life with you that I think are important to who he was and is. And, of course, one of them is his service in World War II. Mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor happened while he was still
In high school.
In high school, right? So what happened when he heard the news about Pearl
Harbor? Sunday, December 7th, 1941, he's walking across, middle of the afternoon, he's walking across Phillips Academy, Andover, Massachusetts boarding school. He's in his fifth year because he had been so sick. He had suffered from a staph infection and been hospitalized for a long time. He immediately wants to sign up. Immediately wants to serve. He told me, as only George Bush could put it, it was a red, white, and blue thing. You know, your country's been attacked. Get into it. And he wanted to, he considered, he told me, going into the Royal Canadian Air Force because the United Kingdom obviously had been at war since September 1st, 1939. It was prevailed upon to wait until June of 42. On June 12th, 1942, he turned 18. He graduated from high school and he became an enlistee of the United States Navy. Wanted to be a carrier-based pilot, became the youngest flying officer in the Navy. On September 2nd, 1944, he was shot down over Chichijima, in the Bonin Islands.
It was this target was a target they'd tried to take out previously.
The day before.
Correct? And they couldn't. It was a radio tower, transmitter tower.
Very important in the chain of islands going back to the home islands.
They knew, after what they'd experienced first time, that going back this second time was very, very dangerous.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I mean, the mortality rate was incredibly high on these jobs. I mean, this is earlier carrier aviation. And he's flying a torpedo Avenger bomber, a big slow plane. He gets hit, sees the wings go up in flames, the cockpit fills with smoke. He finishes the mission, though. He goes in.
He gets the tower.
He gets the tower. He drops the bombs. He goes out to sea. It turns out he's lost his two crewmates, whom he tries to help escape, die. He plunges deep into the sea. He's nearly decapitated coming out of the plane. Fortunately, his life raft landed close enough to him that he could flop aboard it. Yeah. He was out there for about 4 hours. And was then rescued by a submarine. He had the key question out of that experience is, he said, why was I spared? And I think that his life ever since then has been one long attempt to prove himself commensurate with the sacrifice of Del Delaney and Ted White.
You quote Bush as saying of that experience at Chichijima, it was transforming in the sense that you realize how close death can be. You realize painstakingly so the responsibility you just had for the life of someone else.
He's 20 years old.
Amazing.
20 years old. And it just doesn't happen in the current culture. But there he is. He's just turned 20 in June. This was September. Had the lives of others in his hands, and the rest of his life, he had other people's lives in his hands, whether it was a payroll in the oil business or his family or ultimately all of us.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham about his new biography of George H.W. Bush, the 41st President of the United States. After the break, we'll have more with Meacham, including what may have been the saddest chapter in the Bush family story, the loss of their young daughter, Robin, to leukemia.